Okay, you're alive tonight.
All right. This is Chair Mark Frost. I will call to order the City Planning Commission meeting of Tuesday, January 19th. It is 5:31. So tonight's agenda, we have call to order and then the planning director's update. Then we're going to move into a TSP, a transportation system plan amendment discussion led by.
I'll take care of that one, Chair Frost.
Okay, Kevin will lead that. And then we'll have a public hearing continuing our discussion around the middle housing code update. Dustin has some materials to present around that. And then we'll take some testimony from the public, and then we'll have a deliberation. We are looking to review some proposed city municipal code input. And then we need to approve some draft minutes at the end before we adjourn. So I'm thinking that this shouldn't take more than 2 hours tonight, but what we'll do is we'll look for public comment after Dustin has presented the presentation on the middle housing piece, and then we'll take some public comments. So that'll probably be in about half an hour or so. Okay, so with that, Dustin, planning director's update.
Mr. Chair, I think we're going to save our time and get right into the two big items we have for tonight. And we have with us Kevin Liberty. He's a senior planner. He is also the project manager on our TSP 2011 system update or amendment. And then I'll take it from there.
All right, Kevin.
Great. Thank you, Chair Frost and commissioners. Just wanted to give you a quick update and answer questions if you've got them. You will recall we're working right now on preparing some amendments to the city's transportation system plan. These include new cross sections for minor arterial streets and for neighborhood connector streets. We've got some additions and some revisions to project costs for the motor vehicle system, pedestrian and bicycle systems as well. We've done some modeling of traffic impacts for future street and intersection improvements. And we will have some amendments to the TSP document, including some updated maps. The project is addressing recommendations that came out of a series of public hearings that the Planning Commission held following preparation of the West Side Area Concept Plan report. We had about 18 months of public hearings where we were working on refinements to the concept plan. And then the spring and summer of 2019, we spent quite a bit of time going through the streets and transit framework, ped and bike framework, and park and open space. And the Planning Commission, there was a memo ultimately that was prepared with recommendations from the Planning Commission that was forwarded to the City Council. The Council reviewed the memo and they told Dustin, go ahead and move forward with review and implementation of those recommendations. So a scope of work was prepared for this project in June of 2020, and the council approved a resolution so that we could work with DKS and Associates, the same firm that prepared the city's TSP in 2011, and that also worked on the West Side Concept Plan. Council approved a resolution to work with DKS and Associates in July of 20, and we got that contract going. We've been working with them since that time to prepare materials. They've been doing the majority of the work, and we're looking at potentially March 1st as a first public hearing before the Planning Commission, as these changes would be then moving forward ultimately to the City Council once again for final approval. I'm going to run through just real quickly with you the tasks that we've got. Remember, this is pretty narrow in scope. Not a full-blown TSP update, just some amendments that came out of those recommendations and the West Side Concept Plan. And the first task of our scope, revising some of our typical and adding that neighborhood connector street. Staff from both planning and engineering departments did get some feedback to DKS in November on this issue, and we identified a few things that I'm going to need to discuss with you, some areas where the staff is probably recommending some things a little bit different than what the Planning Commission recommended to the council. In task two, we're working on adding and revising project costs in the motor vehicle, pedestrian, and bicycle plans, and updating the functional classification map. That's the map in the TSP that identifies which streets are collectors or arterials, or now neighborhood connectors also being added to that list. The third task in the project is to update the financially constrained project lists in the city's transportation system plan. We spent quite a bit of time talking about the cost of these projects, and we heard a lot from the public, people's interest in getting this infrastructure in place and making sure there was funding for it. So funding is challenging. There are usually more projects than we have money to fund, but one way that we can work on funding is by adding projects into, again, what's called the financially constrained project lists in the TSP. After we take care of that work, we expect to initiate some public outreach through the city's website and gather some additional feedback from the public before we get into public hearings before the Planning Commission and City Council. And that's kind of where we are in a nutshell. Again, looking at potentially the first Planning Commission meeting in March 1, and we hope to get a discussion about the financially constrained project lists in front of the City Council in a work session before then, so we can get some direction from them about the scope and scale of some of these projects and the consequence of, for example, putting all of the things that we want for the motor vehicle system, bicycle system, pedestrian system into the financially constrained project list is ultimately they affect the transportation system development charges that are implemented. And so we need to be cognizant of how those costs add up and what that effect may be on homes and businesses as they're developing in the future. So that's what I've got for you right now. I'm wondering if anybody has any questions about the project that I can answer.
Any questions from the commissioners?
All right. Well, thank you so much.
I guess so. One question for me, just sort of procedure-wise, just a question. So what's the purpose of the March 1st meeting if we've already deliberated on this and we've drafted out the scope? And so what would we hope to achieve in that March 1st meeting?
Well, the hearings that we held for 18 months reviewing the concept plan were based on that concept plan report. And we've taken a subset of those recommendations and we're moving those forward. It's a separate legislative process, narrower in scope. And so we want to make sure that the public has an opportunity to review these before amendments are made to the TSP.
Okay. And then if the meeting is on March 1st, when would we all get and the public get the draft of review? A couple of weeks before or a week before?
I'll need to work with the consultants on that. Typically, we would have materials in advance of a public hearing at least 1 week in advance, and I hope that we can do this more quickly. I think that people will, assuming we do have an opportunity to work with the council on this a bit, I think there will be an opportunity for the public to kind of track some of the discussion that's happening. And again, we do expect to have some more public outreach that occurs through the city's website as well.
Okay. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you, Chair.
All right. Dustin.
Yeah. And just to follow on that, I think one of the scope items that we have is to work through a public workshop before that. A lot of times we see our public outreach come in the past through the way of the legislative process. I think we're looking to actually do more of that in this project. Again, this is a large comprehensive planning project, although based on 18 months of what we've already heard, having another opportunity for the public to see what has come out of that scope and some local refinements, and having that before city council, before the legislative process occurs. It's really, it's not blending the two. It's providing a greater amount of impact and input opportunity before we're in legislative actions. So.
Very good, thank you. All right, so Dustin, over to you for the missing middle house code update discussion. And you're gonna present something?
Yeah, I'm gonna queue up some presentations here. I'm gonna have a couple documents for you. You've been provided these documents earlier in the week, and I have a PowerPoint that helps walk through some of them, but I'm gonna jump back and forth between the PowerPoint as well as the code itself. So if you have that ready, I've starred a couple items that I've heard from some of our stakeholders and some of you from, and some of the items that I've discussed with City Council. So without further ado, we're gonna start walking through this. And I see a number of people here that we have that has contacted me ahead of time that wanna participate. So thank you all for joining in and continuing to engage. Maybe we're sharing screens. All right. Does it look like a presentation?
Not yet.
Okay.
Anybody else see it?
Nope.
No.
Oh, here it
there
comes.
There we go.
Missing Excellent. Middle, missing housing code. Middle housing code, sorry.
There's something there.
Read what you want to hear.
Thank you. Good evening. So tonight I wanted to take you through some of the updates that we've been working on in the middle housing code. And the purpose of tonight's meeting is to have you review the proposed legislation that came in the last week's packet, take some public testimony, and have Planning Commission deliberate and move some recommendations onto City Council, who will be who's the body that has to decide on it. So in our current process, we're here. The blue loop indicates where we are. You've heard some of the technical materials already. Some of those issues have been raised to council, and here's based on some of their feedback, now our opportunity to really get into some of these issues. As a recap for those who may be joining for the first time, the middle housing code, otherwise known as the missing middle, is a general category of homes characterized by duplexes, triplexes, townhomes, and cottage clusters. Generally considered to be a smaller alternative to single family, but intended to be compatible in its scale, and oftentimes traditionally located in the same neighborhoods. Planning Commission started this matter on December 21st, looking at some of the technical aspects of the code, including required setbacks, heights, landscaping standards, unit size limitations, and the use of particular design elements that go into shaping the code. Last week, I took a couple of these items to City Council that were identified at Planning Commission and really from some of our stakeholders and some of our feedback and some of the feedback regarding the code. And I'm going to walk through those as we get into some of the design standards. The code itself, as outlined, has 7 sections. And I'm going to take you through all those. The last being the code development standards, which really is kind of the meatiest and the most technical end. First section, definitions. We have a purpose statement, applicability, the code's relationship to other codes and regulations, how you process exceptions and variances, the land division procedure, as well as mentioned before, the development standards. So before we dig into that, everybody tracking so far?
Yep.
Yep.
I wanted to make a comment. We've been reviewing some of the prototypes, which were provided by Sarah Architects. I wanted to provide some clarification that these prototypes are not the code itself, and really not intended to be the final outcome, but they're really some of the visualizations that really can be derived from the code. So we use these to shape some of the code criteria that we're going to go through. And I think that clarification was needed because some of the feedback we got was that we were starting to get pretty prescriptive and rigid in forming these prototypes. The intent was to help shape the code so that we didn't necessarily and really reverse engineer from the outcomes. So although we show a 600 square foot unit on those, there's not a 600 foot mandate on these code criteria, but we wanted to see, you know, rather than go through a list of alphanumeric standards in the code and use our imagination on what the outcome would be, this looks at some of the outcomes that could be derived from the code and the standards that we're going to look at. So I hope that helps address some of our viewers' concerns regarding some of that flexibility. The code itself gets pretty descriptive, but it's not as prescribed as the prototypes. In the prototypes were our test fits and the lots that we're shown on are the typicals in Hood River, but they're not intended to be the absolute end product. Hopefully though, as we, you know, using the same playbook and rule set, we should be seeing some things that are reminiscent or similar.
So can I ask a question about that?
Yeah.
Dustin, so are you saying that, the code is gonna establish parameters, whether it's lot coverage or what have you, and then developers just work within those guidelines and they can come up with whatever arrangements or housing can fit into those parameters?
That's correct. So the code outlines the sidebars on those. So we kind of set those end parameters on where, on, you know, what is permissible, but it's really intended to be kind of a working toolkit and that somebody will design from.
Okay, so if, for example, a 3-flat isn't shown in these diagrams, it doesn't mean that a developer couldn't figure out a way to create a 3-flat on one of these lots?
Right, and so in that respect, the code talks about detached and attached configurations, okay. Specifically two unit and 3-unit. So they're contemplated in there. And actually one of the test fits does show a 3-unit attached. But that's what's intended.
Okay. So if it's not shown, it doesn't mean we can't do it. It's just, you're giving us examples, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And got it. Thank you.
I'm going to try to jump here into the code so we can see the first 6 sections are important. They're not particularly meaty, but they really set some of the stage to some important aspects of this code. And I'm going to try to bring that up. This is from the document that you were provided last week. And hopefully we're seeing some words.
Definitions.
So this is so the first part, definitions, really this provides and is intended to break down some of the intent. You know, this is supposed to be a clear and objective code. So things need to be very descriptive. So the idea that that we all have the same meaning regarding what does building height mean, what does floor area mean, that can't be left to interpretation. As a code intended for clear and objective standards, this is where we start fitting in some of the definitions, some of the key terms that are loaded into the code. Moving on to purpose statement, this is really you know, this is not in all our code, but I think it's always helpful to at least gather some idea of why are we doing this code? What's the end goal, intent of the code? So I've included a purpose statement that talks about increasing opportunities for home ownership, providing some flexibility, expanding the housing types, and really going back to the housing goals and the comp plan basis that talks about more efficient use of our urban lands that that we have availability for. Applicability. This is a really important statement because it sets up the idea that that where these developments are permitted, they're permitted by right, only subject to the standards below. That they're not bound by the lot layout restrictions of the underlying zoning regulations. This is a really critical element because this is where it sets up a by right standard. So this is not subject to a conditional use criteria. This is not subject to site plan land use approval. These are subject to building permits, just as if you were to build a single family home. In order to help design regulations that are really supportive to a compact development, different from what we have laid out elsewhere, this code 1725 has its own regulation set, its own definition of height, its own definition of gross floor area, and really is custom fit to this middle housing type. So the relationship to other regulations, this is where we it's intended to harmonize those, where we have some regulations that apply to larger formats. Here's where we reconcile and basically state these regulations apply. They're more prescriptive, they're more sized to this development. These are the ruling regulations. Exceptions and variances just need to be put into play. Those will be subject to the same standards and the same process that we do now. Land division options. This is also an extremely critical component because the first statement requires or states that these developments can be created as subdivision, partition, condo, or as rental units unsubdivided. It really provides the whole host of ownership opportunities. This is also something that came up from our stakeholders. There was a statement, and I'd ask some of them about the idea of doing duplexes. And one of the statements I heard back was there's a reason why we don't do non-townhouse duplexes now is because the idea of investing, you know, $800,000 to have a rental property is really unrealistic. Most of them are not sized to hold that type of property. And so the ability to sell them became a very much an incentive. It also became something when it came to home ownership and investment that in order to finance some of these, it became essential to have them be divisible and owned. We continue on with the idea that these subdivisions and partitions are reviewed as expedited land divisions. These are non-land use actions as well, but they need to be done concurrently. So when we look at a development, a middle housing development, we are going to have to know more about the land because these things fit together. The alignment of utilities, the use of open space, some of the design parameters, we will need to see a partition right at the same time. It also, that will be necessary because if you do want to sell off property, you're going to need to have this land plat in place at the time a development starts to occur. Once again, the statement regarding the exemption from individual lot size, frontage requirement, and some of the dimensional standards. This is really in line with some of the planned unit development philosophy that we have, that taking the development as a whole becomes that's really the driving force. It's not the individual unit sizes or the individual lot size themselves that are the driver. It's really this development in its full capacity that we evaluate. It continues on with the needs for providing necessary easements. Also, if you're not going to have a frontage requirement or allow private streets, we need to be very sure that we have cross utility and cross access easements in place. Otherwise, we end up with landlocked properties that really are a non-starter when it comes to buildability and long-term maintenance. Included in that, when you have common property, you need to have common understandings and agreements. So this states the need for conditional restrictions and requirements, CCRs. Also, this same philosophy comes from our PUD standard, where we expect common areas and common tracts. Therefore, we need to contemplate a mechanism on how these are maintained in long term. So that's the first six in a nutshell. Before I dig into the development, I'll take a pause there and see if
it might be a good time for some questions for six. Okay. Any questions from the commissioners on the first six sections?
Not at this time.
I guess, Dustin, I'll say I have probably pages of comments on all of these pages. So process-wise, how do you see that happening?
Well, you get into deliberation afterwards. So procedurally, you got any high-level questions?
Yeah, I don't know if they're, I would qualify them as questions. I guess maybe the only one would be regarding the CCNRs and HOA stuff. And I guess, are you expecting that those would be applicable to all of those, anything in this code for any size project? And then is there an understanding of the implications of that?
I think anything with common elements and cross access are going to be necessary.
And your expectation is that any of these housing formats have 30% open space, so therefore they would be required for any of these development types?
If it's common open space. I expect, if not the open space, the common drive, and I'm trying to...
We haven't got there, but then is there not a requirement for common open space? Part of the code set?
Not in everything. Part of it will be a common open space for cottage cluster.
Okay. That's only applies there.
Right. So your duplex, triplex, they're not included on that, but you will see common driveways. So
okay.
So you still end up with common elements.
I guess that's it for questions now.
Okay, anybody else? All right, section 7.
All right. Sorry about that. All right. First section that we come across here, this is really when we get into our area measurements and number of units that are allowed per zone. This is pretty significant when it comes to the number of units that are going to be permitted. Right now, there's no measurement of minimum lot size, but in terms of dwelling units, you see in R1, each dwelling unit will be required to have 2,500 square feet of area. In the middle code, that means essentially you have two dwelling units, maximum of six. Continuing on, R2, R3, and C1, which are the rest of your residential zones, are one dwelling unit per 1,500 square feet right now, which also includes two units minimum and 12 units maximum. Some of the feedback I got from this is why cap it? Why are we going to have a cap on some of these units? That really goes back to the idea that we're doing that these are permitted uses. These are not uses that are subject to public hearing or subject to a public process. So the idea of capping them to smaller scale units is really kind of in the interest of maintaining some a manageable size and a size that for me on my staff recommendation, I'd be comfortable approving without expecting a regional public process. An unlimited number could see essentially an unlimited size of development. And I don't think necessarily in the way of public participation and transparency that a 100-acre development without a public process is something that I can consider recommending to you. So cap on there really starts to narrow these to smaller individual developments. Again, the idea of we're keeping within the scale of traditional neighborhood makeups.
Can I ask a question? So your typical lot size, is that any specific criteria, decision criteria for you in this?
No, that was more for you all.
Okay.
Just kind of.
So I guess in the final code, if we're looking at the final code set, then we probably don't need things that are informational for us, I guess, right?
No, that could be omitted. It was really more for discussion of how do we look at this. So, that's typical lot base lot size. It's not any site size.
If I do the math on that R1, 1,400 square feet divided by 2,500, you get to 5.5. So how do we get to 6 in a cottage? Rounding up.
Well, that would be the typical. So for example, I mean, if you had 1,500, if you ended up with a 15,000 square foot lot, you could. But at some point, you know, put the ceiling on the...
Oh, the typical base. Okay.
Right. Yeah. Again, it's typical. It's not the mandate. So if you ended up a 7,000 next to an 8,000 square foot lot and you used them together, you could end up with
that. I see.
Same thing with the R2 and R3, the caps on them, they wouldn't fit on, you would need a larger building site in order to achieve the maximum.
Gotcha.
So, and moving on to the allowable types, this is really what Commissioner Lassen was talking about, the idea of how do these things look. We have three kind of general standards, two unit configurations, both attached, detached, three unit, attached, detached, and cottage cluster, which ends up being, by definition, four or more. Also, opportunity to be attached or detached. Our setback standards, the nice thing about this was they were taken directly from the code in the base zone. And they pretty much match one for one. The idea that we stay 5 feet off the sides, 10 foot off the front and the back, those are pretty generous as they are. And in looking at some of the prototypes, I don't think we got any feedback that they needed to be reduced. We did have the discussion about allowing the porches to be an encroachment, and that got pushed back as keeping to the 10 foot allowance, based on kind of some of the observations of Creekside development that we looked at. Lot coverages, they show up in the building, in the matrix that we have. So the matrix ends up being a kind of a cheat sheet for all the zoning codes and some of the key standards. They're keyed in. So again, this is not a typical, but it keys in some of the locations of what, you know, what is a rear lot line, garage sizes, and then we end up using that and going into, some of the matrices in which we start looking at the numbers that show up, such as 51%, 19%, 20%. And I'll circle back to lot coverage when I pull that page up. Public street dedications. This is a kind of an acknowledgement statement. You must comply with the city standards for frontage improvements and underground. Those can vary depending on development, but again, with the intent of trying to consolidate all the code and some of the code provisions into one standard, this shows up. In terms of frontage and connectivity, I got a couple of questions about this section. Street connectivity for blocks. This is from the code. This is taken from the subdivision code, and it talks about making walkable small blocks. This also provides an opportunity to get an exemption from this through the use of shared walkways and some public standards. This becomes important as an import because we are talking about the code that starts driving this this type of development, including their own land divisions. So this is kind of one of the hallmarks to building compact, walkable neighborhoods in from our code, and it's a reason why it gets imported into this standard. It requires, again, that the individual lots that are created, they do not have to have lot frontage. This is a takeaway from the townhouse code, but they are required to have lawful access. So by way of easement, by way of public or private street. Public utility, this is pretty typical for individual lot developments. To have their individual services. So this is hinges or is really based around the idea that these lots and these units will be made for sale. Back to parking. We talked about this at some length earlier this year. I was able to take this to City Council and get some direction from them regarding parking. This is a particularly noteworthy item and a departure from our code, removing the 2 space per minimum that's required for all these units in our code now, and allowing a 1 space per minimum or some at least flexibility there. This sets the baseline in the code for a minimum one per unit, and states also in its location that they're not going to be located between the street and between the units in the street. So therefore pushing the units to the front in a traditional capacity and moving the parking to the back or the alternate. We can refer to the pictures and some of the impacts that has to the right of way into the street frontage when you have, when we start loading our vehicles to the front. A statement that does not allow these to be required in the setbacks. Parking is not allowed in the setback, and except for in our alley load configurations, will not be located between the street and the right of way. You'll probably hear more about that too. That was also raised for some concern about how that would look and the impacts for impervious surfaces on site. Moving through these driveway approaches, this is a pretty significant one for the development as well. Really forcing the access of shared accesses onto these lots and into these development, reducing the amount of curb cuts that we see today, rather than each individual lot or user having their own access point, we consolidate the access, or that's recommended. It's recommended to save curb space that is going to be needed if these units are going to require the street for parking. It's also a way to stop the breakup of public access by way of sidewalks, and also provides an opportunity for landscaping out front. And here's 2 looks that you have with a 2-unit and are forcing the access to the rear of properties. As you can see, if you can see my cursor, this is the zone that all of a sudden becomes more of a landscape element, more of a pedestrian element, and allows these buildings to not sit behind driveways. We continue on into some of the landscape and softscape. The first section encourages but does not require the use of stormwater and LID features. We don't have a full LID code in place, and we want to encourage folks from using that or to use that that technology that's available, with the understanding that a lot of this is going to be infill, and some of the the opportunity to use LID and infill is going to be really challenging because we're going to have a limited amount of open space. And we're going to have neighbors. You're going to have neighbors with existing grades that you're going to have to match. So providing an opportunity, encouraging this is something that's recommended to be in the code, but it's not recommended to be in the provision. Here's some of the landscape elements that end up being in place. I left the highlight on this piece because this is an area on landscape and open space that really garnered a lot of attention. If we're going to require 30% total lot development be landscape, which is on par with our PUD standards, planned unit developments, there was a concern that the wetland or steep slopes not being counted was going to encourage, it was kind of counter to the environmental aspect of it, from preserving those places from being developed. The tension that occurs there and the trade-off is some of these spaces are really difficult for activities and for more active recreation. But the environmental aspect would be to give credit. So I left this one highlighted for discussion. It's, you know, our standard, I would be looking for Planning Commission to weigh in on whether space constrained areas such as wetlands would be counted towards open spaces, or whether they, if they're not buildable, should they be omitted from that, from crediting towards that. The requirement for parking and drive areas do not qualify as open space. It may seem a little redundant, but again, this needs to be clear and objective, and having it in the code puts people on notice. Street frontage, this is from our street standards. One street tree, 2-inch caliper for every 30 inches. Again, it's just good to incorporate that into our little more encompassing development standards. This one is a bit of a departure. We do not require street tree planting off the frontage. This starts to instill some landscaping and buffering between the building and the units now. If you're gonna see developments with increasing density, one of the tactics or one of the methods to promote compatibility and scalability is to use landscaping between them. And this perimeter buffer is intended to do just that, is to include within the landscape and we're within the setback areas, some amount of landscape to be built. So it encourages the planting of trees. It also is intended to provide a compatibility and scalability between developments that may have different density in the same area. As mentioned, the cottage clusters have private open space, as well as requirements for direct pedestrian access to all units. This will require units that don't have frontage to have a direct access and walk to them. So you're not walking down a driveway or having to walk through someone's yard. You are provided a path to your unit. The common open space for our cluster configurations, this again points back to the cottage cluster requiring square footage for each unit. That's a scalable standard. Requiring units to abut the open space and requiring that the open space be completed prior to the final plat or tied to the first occupancy. So being completed prior to occupancies. This is intended to not allow the open space to linger on until after all the units are dealt with. Getting into one of the most meaty matters was the dwelling unit size restrictions. Initially, we talked about not having a hard ceiling for this, but considering all the amenities to be the driver. And this was a matter that City Council discussed as well. The concern that if the code was too restrictive and created too much of a gap between what was permitted there now, that the development community and builders would simply reject the idea of building middle housing and choose something that was more advantageous, that allowed a stronger market or was better suited for the market. This was something we talked about in December on a square foot by square foot basis in some of the prototypes against some of the typical, and I use the townhouse requirement. So in reviewing that and also going back and looking at the potential loopholes that could be, if we had somebody who wanted to step away from some of the densities that were calculated, we could actually end up seeing them consolidate all the square footage into fewer units that became not middle-sized, but really full-sized. And so in order to stop that full-size loophole, I did end up putting a ceiling in here on dwelling unit sizes. 1,100 square foot for those without a garage, 1,500 square feet for those including a garage. And as we're looking at a planned unit development, the limitation on expanding those beyond square footages, again, this kind of goes back to the townhouse configuration. If you're building multiple units in a planned unit development of sorts, although not a PUD, it's going to be difficult. And people need to be put on notice that they may not have the ability to continue to expand their dwelling unit within the confines of this code. And building orientation and separation, we are expecting multiple units in close proximity, clustered around each other. So setting a clear standard on what is the expectation that those units be set back from one another. We have a 10-foot separation between the exterior walls of the dwelling units. This would provide an opportunity to split the lots between the two and also allow each of these to have at least 6 feet or 5 foot setback from a future lot line. Getting closer to that starts resulting in some building code impacts. When it comes to proximity to the lot line, we start losing the ability to have unrated openings. So this was the recommended standard to create at least a minimum amount of separation or a comfortable amount of separation from the walls. The method and height gets picked and is actually described specifically for this dwelling unit. Current code is now 28 feet as measured from the original grade. And that's described and debated on most projects. The proposal here is 25 feet. This allows for a two floor development, but also limits that upper ceiling. And I can show you, this is also intended to be from future lot grade. The idea of doing pre-development grade is really difficult here because we are talking about clustering these units together. So you're gonna end up with radical variability on slope sites or sites with some topography. These things have to have common driveways, or they're intended to have common driveways, common elements, common utilities in some instances, and that needs to be aligned. So having radical different starting points for some of our height measurements becomes really challenging to have a unified development. And I'll show you what this looks like in code. So this is starting, rather than using pre-development, this is using an average development grade calculation, and this would end up in the code as well. This is how we would describe, or how we recommend describing the base point for the height calculations. We also provide some silhouettes from what a flat roof would be, including necessary parapets, what a shed roof would be, and then what a pitched roof would be. One omission from this, it initially said 6-12 minimum pitch. That's now been omitted to provide some flexibility on the pitched roof types. But you could see this is how we now have measured our 25 feet. There's some bounce there for grade changes. But again, this is kind of goes back to the idea of scalable units in scale with some of the surrounding products that we have in place today.
Hey, Dustin, could I ask you a couple of questions? This is this set of pictures or I guess examples. Have we seen this in our packet, or is this, I don't remember seeing this before.
This one's in here, as well as
but the contents of this packet we have not yet seen.
No.
Okay. Well,
we saw the axonometric in the top section, but we hadn't seen the flat roof one or the.
Yeah. Okay.
These two came after I produced the packet. We were getting a lot of concern about this does not reflect other building types. Are you going to prohibit flat roofs? Are you going to prohibit the shed? So these were late adds on these two.
Okay. And then could you go back to the text section where you were reviewing this?
Yep.
And I'm not quite sure what the purpose of the three statements there are. One and two seem to be redundant unless I'm missing something.
I think the statement would be eaves and parapets versus the ridge, the pitched ridge. And it'll be substituted by basically saying refer to the exhibits.
And we're looking for there's a definition at the beginning of this section. Is there not? I mean, at the beginning of the code set?
Yeah, and my recommendation would be to use, you know, the average grade is described here.
Okay.
Because this departs from the standard definition from our code, which basically says, you know, two sections. One is 28 feet measured from the high point, or as you know, the site is greater than 10 feet, you measure 10 feet above the lowest point. So this, but that's from original grade. That's not from post-development grade. So in subdivision scenarios where you're trying to balance the site and actually build multiple units, that becomes practically impossible. Or it becomes problematic. I can go back to the words if you like.
Yep, that's good. You answered my question. It seems like there's some consolidation that we could do there.
Absolutely. I think here, again, the using the picture as the basis, I think it is definitely recommended rather than trying to define what is height in terminology. Required architecture, there's some basic standards. Again, this is not going to be a public facing document. So are there some required standards that should be evaluated? This is taken on a couple different features, but this is essentially the same as what you saw before. Eliminating the use of blank walls, considering eaves 15 inches or greater, using trim, using windows and doors and openings that face a public open space or street. So again, this is the idea of orienting units towards common spaces as well as the public domain. The front
it's now
porch.
The time to make a comment on trim.
Mm-hmm.
I think the trim requirement is a little antiquated.
Do you believe it should be more or less?
Well, I don't think trim should necessarily be required. I think the thing that you're trying to avoid is, you know, you see spec homes and suburban developments where they put trim on the front elevation and not on the side elevation. You know, a lot of contemporary architecture doesn't include trim, and that doesn't mean that it's not done nicely. So I would be curious what others thought about the trim, or now is not the time to be talking about trim.
And I think you're going to get into some deliberation, but these are recommendations. I don't think this is one of the matters that really got a whole lot of traction. So I think that's
okay.
I think we're it wasn't raised to be an issue, but I certainly support professional architects weighing in. And then into permitted obstructions. This has been a point of contention in the past. So we've narrowed this to what is permitted. What is a permitted obstruction? Not should avoid any items such as similar or significant. This is the list. So the allowance of driveways, the allowance of fences under 4 feet, driveways within a certain width, eaves, chimneys, and gutters. There's a short discrete list. And again, with this, it needs to be discrete. It needs to be clear. If we're going straight into permitting, there's no room that really we have for judgment and interpretation. We end up going right into land use law and land use decisions if we're starting to interpret. And then pulling in the fence definition from the outside the code, bringing it in, again, having a clearinghouse for the code, including the fence restrictions that would apply. And really being more restrictive, this is again, is in the cottage clusters, the idea of fencing off the open space and fencing off your neighbor is not necessarily something that is really envisioned. So the greater restriction on fence heights and more prescription regarding how fences can be used has an important place here. And then at the end, the cleanup, this really starts to envision the idea that there are developments that may already be built upon that may be expanded to include some of the clusters. The idea that we have housing out there on large lot that may have the opportunity to do some clusters, this is how we would evaluate evaluate those homes against the cottage code or against the middle code. And then the last piece, the ADUs, this one I know was also debated and I got some feedback on. The code reads the ADUs would not be permitted in middle housing development right now. That really comes into the idea that the units themselves are scaled small. So, I mean, when we're looking at units that are 600 square feet, what is the differentiate them between accessory and non-accessory? They're just a unit. Not placing a size or a standard on them. This is just the number of dwelling units. Therefore, taking away this idea of accessory dwelling units, they're all just dwelling units with the same standard. So, and that's where that fits into the code. Sorry if that went longer than 15 minutes.
Okay. Any clarifying questions for Dustin before we, so what we'll do is we'll have the commission ask any clarifying questions before we deliberate. And then we can go to some public input and then we'll come back for our deliberation. So any clarifying questions?
Hey, Dustin, thanks for including the existing homes. Is there an example in Hood River of a larger home with a larger lot? I'm thinking of like the end of Pine Street. It's like Pine and Third. It's a gigantic home with a huge lot. Would that be permissible to do something like this with?
Yeah, I'm trying to think about Pine and Third, that one.
Next to the park?
It's not right next to Wilson. It's down the street from Wilson. It's like, it's got some sculpture. It's a huge garage. It's like a 6 or 7 stall garage.
Oh, the lodge. You mean the lodge on the corner.
Yeah, it's on the corner. Pine and Third.
Yes.
Yeah. So what's the question?
The question is, I think that larger homes like this, I don't see them being the best suited for single family homes versus taking that type of home and making it into, with that lot size, to be a great density infill for a cottage cluster. Is there an option to do something like that with, or are there other examples that I can't think of?
Well, I think that's the intent, is where you have an oversized lot with a house on it, that opportunity becomes available. I think about more as you get to the western side of the city, where you have some of the more what used to be rural areas, even some of the manufactured or mobile homes that are out there, the opportunity of those kind of those former farmettes on large format, low density zoning to not necessarily have to be scraped, but they'll have an opportunity to start providing a little bit of compact development on those formats. So if you have a 14,000 square foot or a double lot, having the opportunity to start thinking about, rather than starting from scratch, some sort of infill. So that's definitely what the section is intended for, is to allow people with existing development to contemplate. Or some of the houses, especially along Belmont, as you get on the south side, 18th, 20th, you start seeing those smaller, actually really small format homes from the 40s or before on rather large lots. This would be an opportunity for those lots to also provide some infill. They're all on a collector street. The lot to house ratio is pretty small. It would basically allow you the opportunity to save the house, if not, rather than scrape it. So.
Dustin, I have just sort of a general question about this document. Some of the things in here are issues, as you mentioned, that we discussed at our last meeting, like ADUs and parking, and we didn't really arrive at any decision. We kind of debated them from all sides. And now some things have been put in here. Is that reflecting staff input or city council input, or like, yes. where did this come from?
And some of your input, I mean, in narrowing. So the issues that we've seen and come from Planning Commission, without you arriving at it, I needed something to react to. Otherwise we would just spiral out of to the land of all opportunities. You know, it's kind of like drawing a line in the sand and letting you say, okay. Does it sounded okay. Like sentiment, you know, one side or another. So
this isn't something that went to city council, because I missed the last city council meeting, and they said we want this or we want that. That's not the case. This is like giving us something to react to.
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay, got it. Thank you.
It does build into some of their input. It also builds in some of the input that we got from our development community on some of the things that they saw as fatal flaws or some things that just didn't make sense.
Okay.
It made sense to the staff, but not to the end users. So I needed to reconcile some of that.
Okay, fair enough. Thanks.
Okay, any other further questions, clarifications for Dustin? So while we do that, let's have a, for those that want to speak, there's a option to raise your hand. I wonder if you could do that so we can get an idea of how many people want to speak tonight. I think, Dustin, you said that we have three people, Greg Crafts, Thrive Hood River, Nancy Roche. Those are the three that you had previously, correct?
Yeah, I think everyone, remember star nine to raise your hand if you want to.
On the phone? Okay.
If you're on the phone.
Okay, so I'm seeing two or three hands raised. Okay, so why don't we try and move it along with sort of 5 minutes, plus or minus 5 minutes for your comments from public, unless you want some more time, I think that should be good. So raise your hand, we will promote you to being able to ask your question, come off mute. So who's
Mark, would you like to call the first person and then I'll promote them in order?
All right, let's go with Thrive Hood River. Okay.
Hi, this is Heather Satan from Thrive Hood River. I actually had a question to start with, which is about the development table that was referenced, but I haven't seen a development table that includes lot coverage in this packet. Am I missing that? This is for a question for Dustin.
It's not in this packet. It was from December 21st. I can bring it up for your review.
Oh. Thanks. That would be great. I think that would have been quite helpful for the public because, you know, one of the determinations for a builder is kind of how much land they have to work with, and lot coverage is a big aspect of that. So that would be great to see. So as you guys know, the City of Hood River has been working towards creating missing middle housing codes since at least the 2015 housing needs analysis. The West Side Area Plan also had provisions aimed at creating more middle housing. So you guys have been working on this for fits and starts for a long time. And now you've got some code in front of you, and it's probably pretty tempting to move through this as quickly as you can. After all, housing affordability and availability in Hood River is just getting worse and worse. But I want to start with a cautionary tale. About a decade ago, Hood River adopted code to permit ADUs, but the code was so burdened with poison pills that even though ADUs were allowed, almost nobody built them. And a few years ago, you liberalized the ADU code, the barriers were removed, and we've seen robust ADU production. The point is, take the time to do the analysis you need to have a degree of certainty that builders will build these. I said in my comments, the City of Hood River doesn't build houses, builders build houses. They have to take you up on these product types or they will not get built. You should also have a degree of certainty that overall housing production will rise and that the end products will help residents at the income levels that Hood River has identified as having a shortage of housing opportunities in price ranges that don't leave them cost burdened. The zoning code is a really powerful tool. It offers real incentives and opportunities, and it's worth taking the time to get the economic analysis and information you need to have a degree of confidence that this code is going to make a difference in the lives of people who live in Hood River. A couple of specific things. I've had a number of builders tell me that the 900 square feet limit on dwelling unit size in cottage clusters is too small. I've had people tell me that the code is missing a fourplex opportunity. It seems like you've got opportunities to build duplexes and triplexes. And then if you want to build four units, you're into a cottage code, but they have to be such a very small unit. I had some builders do a little pricing for me, and they thought that their development cost is not their land cost, but their development cost for an 1100 square foot unit is about $225,000. But for a 600 foot unit, it's $180,000. That's the difference between $300 and $200 a square foot. So the 600 square foot unit, I know we all think they would be awesome, but unless we can allow a very big number of them, like six, on a property, you're not gonna get people building, you know, a 5,000 square foot unit, I mean lot with two 600 foot cottages. It just is not going to pencil. So I really want you guys to ask for the analysis. You could get Echo Northwest to make these sort of judgments for you or give you some advice. I think that just you're flying pretty blind if you don't have a sense of the marketability of these products and if builders are going to think that they pencil out. So I really suggest that you do that kind of work. And that's it for my comments.
Thanks, Heather. All right, we have a Mike Kettler. Anybody else who wants to speak, please raise your hand. Okay, Mike. Yeah,
this is Mike Kettler. Yeah, I think I just echo the same thing that she was just speaking about. There needs to be some kind of incentive to build the cluster housing. you know, the immediate things that I look at this that are killers is going to be the improvement cost, your utility cost. There's nothing that really addresses how, when you have an existing lot, how are we going to basically attack the utility improvement to build cluster housing on an existing lot? The other thing that I think is probably something to look at is the lot coverage. But the biggest thing is, just like she spoke before, was there needs to be some kind of incentive from the city to entertain a developer to take on the cluster housing. Because she's right. The reality is the margin isn't there to build three lots on an R2 lot, because your land cost is going to be so burdensome that your end product, you're going to end up with a developer is going to have to try to sell a 1,000 square foot cluster home for $475, which still isn't the target you're going for, unless you can shave land cost, because the build cost is going to be the build cost, whether you're at 1,000 or at 15 or at 19, you're going to be, you know, within the same margin of your build cost. It's all going to be made up in your land cost, and that's going to be made up with how much you have to spend on your development cost to get to a cluster housing. So I think that would be the thing I'd pay attention to is don't rush it to get it out there, but there needs to be good thought and incentive that this is something developers and builders actually want to do. So I guess that's the only thing to think about is just that the land incentive to actually produce them. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Mike, for those comments. All right. Next up, we have Nancy Roach. Nancy, you should be live.
Can you hear me?
Yep, can hear you.
Thanks. Yep, okay. My name's Nancy Roach. My address is 2 Eugene Street. My husband, Greg Crafts, will not be speaking. He sent an email with fairly detailed comments to, I think, to Dustin with the...
Yeah, we received those. Thank you.
Okay, great. And Greg worked with Doug Beveridge and Mike Kitts for 20 years to create entry-level housing. I was involved indirectly because I was busy with other things, including serving on the Kirkland Planning Commission up in Washington State when Microsoft was just getting going, and the Microsoft impact drove land prices sky high over the course of just less than a decade. So I understand this issue at a gut level, because I know a lot of people who had to leave Kirkland because of the land use prices. My perspective started more in theory as a planning commissioner and evolved as Greg started building houses, entry-level houses here, because I've seen the direct impact of regulation on the cost of entry-level homes. Personally, I'm a big fan of well-intended regulation because I think generally they exist to protect community standards. But I also know from experience that there are unintended consequences of those good intentions. I was going to comment in more detail, but after Dustin's really excellent presentation and talking about this at length with Greg and Mike and listening to what Heather and Mike Keller said, I really agree with the concept of reality testing these. And I think it might be helpful, just as a short reality test, identify several lots where this kind of development could take place and see how the proposed regulations would work in real life. And I'm happy to volunteer both Mike Kitts and Greg to do something like this, because I have some leverage and because they both actually have put their money where their mouth is on this stuff and they really care passionately about this. And I suspect Doug Beveridge, who's traveling internationally right now, would like to be involved along with other developers, because this is a topic that's very near and dear to the development community heart. So I think that Heather's proposal to get more, of a professional level impact or test of economic viability and actually just sitting down and saying, what would you do here? Here's a lot. What would you do? That house at Third and Pine, I know I walk by there regularly and I have thought, God, you could put two little houses there. How would that work? So I think, just looking at what our reality is could really improve these and increase the chances that they will be built. Because as the parent of two adult children, one of which has a house here and the other one doesn't and has very little chance of being able to afford a house here, given current circumstances, this is something that matters to me. That's all. And if you want Greg and Mike to do it, Dustin has my email, and I will get them to do it, I promise.
Nancy, I really appreciate the comments. Thanks very much. Those are great.
Okay.
Okay, anyone else from the public who wants to provide any comments? All right, seeing none. So, Dustin, we're going to move to the deliberation. Are there some salient points that we want to walk through and get some specific feedback around? I took some notes.
I think the
the non-buildable open space wetland discussion. Do you have a list?
I think that that was a highlighted feature. Would you qualify, I call it environmentally restricted properties as open space? I can bring up the lot coverage that came in your December memo just to show you what it is on par with what the code would require. The height issue, I think that's something that Bill had raised. And it's actually rather significant when it comes to the amount of, it draws right into scale and compatibility as well as buildability. So to me, those would be the big three.
So the environmentally restricted one, the dwelling unit size restriction, and the height issue, the 25 feet height issue. Those are the big three.
I think those are, I mean,
it's a place to start
discussion, but I think that really, you know, a lot of things just kind of, you set those standards and a lot of things just kind of develop off those. You know, I think that's really the basis of a lot of land development. So,
okay.
Hey, Mark, can I
ask Bill. Yep.
Housekeeping type stuff? So it's hard for me to review and have opinion or comment, and I think the public as well, when we don't have complete information. And so I don't feel like, I feel like we owe everybody the some more complete packet at some point. And that's gonna be including diagrams and then also development tables that weren't provided and things like that. So I guess next time we have a discussion about this topic, let's have the full packet together. And then as far as the code set goes, there's not any page numbers in it. So if we could add some page numbering so we can reference stuff and or section numbering. And I think we are pretty consistent in our existing code set with 17.0.4. whatever. But I felt like going through this stuff, it's gonna be hard for us to really have discussion on particular segments of it because of its layout, or because it needs a little more numeration.
Okay, but Bill, you had started at the beginning saying you had some notes on a lot of the document. Is that something that you want to walk through? Because it might include more than just those three issues that we discussed.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to. You know, and some of these are probably, I think we should have a general discussion. Half my comments are probably getting a pulse of the commission and kind of an opinion and help, you know, kind of give Dustin some input. A few of them are probably things that I would say most commissioners might say, yeah, we should do that. Like I an example might be, as I'm reading through here, there are some places where I would think we want to make sure we understand what the building code implications of some of these are. And I don't know whether, and Greg, one of the commenters used an example where the planning said you could do this and the building code said you couldn't. So I think if we're going to be designing or testing some of these things, we need to make sure that we engage the building department to see if there's any issues that are going to be that are going to arise. For example, I mean, I got a list of three pages of stuff like that. So,
Okay, Well, I wonder if we want to go through those first three first, and then there's other things on your list that you would like to bounce ideas off. That might be a good time to do, so that Dustin can take this away and update accordingly. Okay, so then why don't we get each person's thoughts around those three major things. So the environmentally restricted, the dwelling unit size, and then the height issue. Let's start with those three. So Bill, since you're hot, Mike, do you want to give us a thought about those?
Environmentally restricted, are we talking about the slope and wetland open space issue?
Right. So should those be automatically considered part of the open space?
I think that should, I think I've been trying to figure out whether we're planning to see these projects as kind of, you know, open field blue sky projects, or whether these are going to be infill projects. And certainly I think we live in a place with a lot of topography and everything else. So I feel like those things need to be preserved. And I think counting them toward open space is, we should definitely be allowed to do that. I have, you know, back onto the comment on open space in general, I was trying to figure out what are the lot coverage, what are the open space requirements, so I could understand what they were. And I don't know what they are. So I don't feel like I can comment on those things. I do know that lot coverage is continually challenging from a development perspective. And we end up with a lot of funky PUDs and funky partitions and everything else because people are jiggling property lines. And I know from trying to lay out and develop stuff myself that lot coverage is literally the one of the critical things that is preventing us from getting some density. And so I think we need to understand what the lot coverage, the proposed lot coverage is in these development standards so that we can comment on them. And I think the comment of test fitting some subject parcels around town is a really great idea. Onto the building height, I don't know if I have any particular comment because I didn't really look at the diagrams that we don't have, but I think generally, I think we should have an overall building height standard discussion. I've been kind of one of my hot buttons for a while, and I think we should fix that versus define something new that we have to juggle against. I do think that I saw a bunch of comments on the 28 foot height. I would advocate that given the constraints of land and the fact we're trying to achieve some density, that we revert to whatever our general standard is, 28 feet high or 35 or whatever it turns out to be. And what was the other one you wanted to comment on?
Well, it was the dwelling unit size restrictions.
Oh, I didn't know that I clearly understood the difference between the diagrams and the numbers in the diagrams and the development standard and then the code set. So I don't know if I have an opinion other than when I looked at some of that stuff and saw 600 and 900 square foot footprints, it seems economically unfeasible. I don't know. I think the 1100 or 1500 for a garage is still possibly prohibitive for some of these formats. And I guess the question is, are we trying to, I don't know, the middle housing is probably trying to serve two constituents. One's a renter and then the other one's an owner. And I think we should consider, you know, is a three bedroom property something that we want to make available through the middle housing code set? And if so, does that number need to be increased a bit? Mm-hmm. I guess that's
excellent.
Top three.
Okay, thanks for those comments. Who wants to go next?
Well, Mark, can I make a suggestion that maybe rather than we each go through all three of these, can we just maybe start with the space one and talk through that?
Okay.
Since it's a lot of different topics. Because I guess I have some just kind of questions and concerns, and I'd like to hear everybody else's thoughts on the whole open space, personal space issue. I think I agree with Bill. I think wetlands and hillsides can certainly be considered open space because we'll be protecting them anyway. And again, we're trying to build density here, so we can't sort of have everything we want. So I would say wetlands as open space is great. But I guess I just question this sort of community open space idea anyway. I think if we're looking to get, you know, more housing in a on a piece of land, something's got to give. And I think everybody's going to sort of prioritize personal space over open space, or at least that's my presumption. Tell me, other people tell me if you think I'm wrong. So I don't know that I think we need a parameter for shared open space, aside from things like, you know, driveways that are going to be there by definition. But I think we should maybe look at dividing up this land so people have a patch of personal space, and then protect wetlands or whatever else needs to be, and then just abandon this idea of communal open space requirement.
Dustin, are we mandating the communal open space? I know that we want to walk to the units, but are we, is there a number that we had proposed, you had proposed?
There's not a hard number in there, but there should be one. But I think if we're going to walk back from, there's a 30% open space requirement. It doesn't say how it's set.
Right.
So there is some common open space guidance, but if you wanted to, there's definitely an opportunity. I mean, there's nothing mandating a common open space element in a cottage cluster. Just kind of changes its perspective when you change the lot size. You're then essentially relying on the 30% overall to get you there. It's just, however you achieve it, it just becomes a number at that point and less prescriptive.
I'm reading two different things in the code set. One place, and I, this is the question I was trying to ask before, Dustin. There's something, it's in, I think it's H, A. There's two A's, so under H, landscape and openscape, a minimum of 30% of total lot development should be landscape designed or preserved. And then there's another comment under common open space for cottages that says at least 50% shall be preserved. So I'm trying to, maybe you could highlight the, what you're trying to achieve with those two separate comments or specifications.
Sorry, where was your second citation, Bill? I got the first one, 30%.
It's in common open space, number one. And this is, again, we don't have page numbers, we don't have numbering, so that's the challenge. So.
Bottom of the same page.
Yeah.
At least 50% of the cottages shall abut a common open space.
Okay, that's abutting, so it doesn't contain it. Okay.
Yeah, it's just 30%. It just that's more an orientation, not a different number.
Okay, understood.
Yeah, but number two says the common open space shall have at least 100 square feet of area for each unit in the development. So we are specifying common space there.
Okay.
So you would look at, here's 100 square feet, the whole thing, whether it's common open space or whether it's landscaping, side yard, you end up with 30%. And that's kind of what we started with the P, you know, using the PUD as an analogous feature, is that this is not individual lot coverage. This is the site. This is the entire site. Because in a common open space configuration, it may be 100%, you know, all on one lot, yet the entire development has, you know, your individual lots may have very little open space, but collectively they should be achieving a 30% requirement.
Yeah, I guess I'm saying allocate it, because these are going to be individually owned units, right? So allocate it to the home rather than this communal collective space.
So if we look at the diagram that is on page page 9, and is the diagram that shows how we should achieve access. I'm trying to understand that particular diagram. Well, one, I'm trying to understand that diagram because these are 4-unit configurations and we only allow 2 and 3-unit configurations. But I'm trying to understand this diagram as it relates to an open space discussion.
I'll pull that up. Pull it up if you want to share.
Yeah. This is page 9. It's center of the page.
Yeah. Hopefully you're seeing.
Yep. See two plans. Yeah.
So the idea would be rather than counting, say, for example, the middle lot here, which may not have all the open space associated with it, taking the entire development at large and counting the entire development towards meeting a landscape area.
So would we put some open space constraint on these particular lots? Like would we say, you know, guy number, you know, on the left, number one, sorry, you can't put a garden shed in your backyard? Or is that his backyard or is that everybody's backyard? And yeah, how does this relate to our lot coverage requirement?
So this is where the entire same philosophy, it's the entire development, entire lot. So this user, and I don't know if you can see my cursor, this user on the inside gets to, in this particular instance, ends up with part of the driveway on their property, but it serves the whole development. We're looking at the whole development, not just the individual lots themselves. So this is where it would differ from a townhouse where you end up with a lot development and each of them have to meet their, you know, on their own, stand on their own. This departs from that philosophy saying the entire development needs to stand on its own, not each individual lot. So 30% is calculated by the entire site, building coverage by the entire site, not on a lot by lot basis. Like a PUD, you can't calculate a lot if all of a sudden the lot itself has no size restriction. So
flexibility. Understood. There. So is question, in this, do we have a specific lot coverage requirement for individual lots as part of this code set?
No.
I couldn't tell that because there was some lot coverage calculation and some pictures. We don't have a development table. So there's no specific lot coverage requirement.
No individual.
Okay.
And I can show you, so let me go to the code work. On the 21st of December, we handed out the matrix table that had this code in it, and I'll pull it up for you right now. This is what was provided to Planning Commission and made in the packet at that time. So this is lot coverage, not for an individual lot basis, but and it should be building site. And this is how it laid out.
Okay. So you're expecting that some table like this is part of this code set?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts?
It becomes a way to organize it rather than by words. It's a single sheet. So.
Okay. Who else wants to put some input into open space?
But I feel like I'm just throwing darts at a dartboard here. I tend to like a more libertarian approach to this and letting the developers tell us what they want. I agree with Tina. Green space to me is more important than open space versus private or public. And especially if we're going to let the developer
cat drama.
Let the, especially if we're going to let the developer pick what they want to do with parking, then let them pick what they want to do with common space or green space. And this is very hard for me without going back to what Heather and Mike were saying about let's get some top 10 lots around the city and see how what we're talking about plays into it.
Okay. I don't know if Greg and Mike got signed up for 10, but
we could probably get 10 builders to each do one or two.
Okay, let's keep going around the horn. Why don't we keep moving here? So Amy and Erica, we hadn't heard your input there on the open space question topic.
Yeah, so I'll go ahead. I think for open space, I am fine with allowing wetlands to be considered open space. I think the most important aspect of open space or green space or what have you is that it's useful. And I think having space that is for wetlands or preserving some sort of environmental aspect, I think that it would be considered useful. And I think that's the important thing. I mean, and then I also have a question about just open space in general of what the intent is of that communal open space. For me, it should be usable, but are we thinking in general that common open space, if we decide to have a specific common open space, what is the purpose of that? Is it for people to have picnics? Is it for people to be able to kick soccer balls? Is it people to do cartwheels? What is the purpose of that space?
That's probably a good topic for us to debate, because we have planned to have parks in proximity to a lot of these things.
I think it's also about the open space also goes hand in hand with the lot coverage and ensuring that everything's not solid structure and that there's room for daylight and view corridors and that you're not, so that the lot is somewhat permeable and you're not just getting solid squares of structure one after another. But I agree with that steep slope areas and wetlands should be considered part of open space, and I don't think we should dictate if the open space is common or individually held. I think the developers can determine that as well. But, making sure that there are obviously the utility and circulation corridor easements within the lot. And that I'm not quite sure how those play in with an open space, if those can constitute as part of the open space or not.
I agree with Erica. I think Megan said the same thing. I think I agree with the idea that wetlands or other sensitive areas should be protected, but also count towards the open space ratio. And I don't think we should determine any ratio between what's open space and what's private space. I think people are going to buy a type of development that they either want a backyard space to grow vegetables in or that they want the homeowners association to maintain. So I think as long as that's clear when people make that purchase decision, I think the market will determine what people end up wanting to buy. So
to summarize a couple of things, it sounds like there was some consensus to not have a private and public separation requirement, right?
Yep.
It sounds like, I mean, I've been trying to get my head around this, but it seems like if we have no lot coverage requirement, which is, that's what I've heard, there's no lot coverage in here, then the overall development will have some open space requirement. It seems like there's consensus to have that. Yes?
Yes.
And then it seems, for me, it feels like the 30% is an arbitrary number. We used it because we used it in PUD. But I'll inject some opinion here, but it seems to me like we should understand what that percentage needs to be, so that we can see some of these properties developed. And maybe we do that with some test fitting or somewhat economic viability or some other thing. We need to figure out what that open space requirement is. Unless we've already done that through the diagrams that were developed.
Yeah, and that's part of the purpose of the prototypes too, is to show what if you hit this number, what does it look like? So they all support the number that's in there, and more. So going down to 30% isn't going to compromise or doesn't run amok of any of the prototypes that were submitted on our 5,000, 7,000, 10,000, 14,000, which, although not the perfect number in every scenario, generally fits to R1, R2, R3 lot sizes. Mm-hmm.
So there's not going to be a lot coverage? We're not including a lot coverage number in here?
It's on individual lots. So not on a lot by lot basis. There's a 30% open space, but there is also a maximum lot coverage for the entire site.
For the site. Yeah. Okay. What about a driveway parking maximum? We had the figures in that December packet of, you know, various configurations and what percentage was allotted to driveways and parking. Is that something we're going to have in the final code? Is there consensus on that?
Oh, I had it rolled into the allowable lot coverage, same as we do now.
Okay.
Whether it's driveway or whether it's a building, it counts.
So let me clarify, because I'm totally confused now. So we are going to have an overall lot coverage for the entire development.
The entire development, not lot by lot basis.
Okay. Then is that the same or different than the open space requirement?
It's about the inverse.
It seems like, then why are we defining two things that to accomplish the same thing, or simplicity? Let's get rid of one of them.
Well, how would you count it? We don't count decks. We don't count patios or hardscape. So that's part of the reason. It provides flexibility between a parking space, driveway, building footprint, and then what is open space. So there, with a little buffer in there and wiggle room, it provides some opportunity. So if you tack the margins side by side to max and min, there's going to be nothing in between.
Well, the lot coverage at whatever, if we have a lot overall lot coverage, then, and parking and things have to be extracted, can't be included or included in lot coverage, the rest of it's going to be something that is green. Right. It's confusing to me that we have both of those standards. I would advocate we eliminate one of them.
Yeah, I will tell you based on using this,
have lot coverage, I don't think.
What's that?
PUD doesn't have the concept of lot coverage. That's why that's why we keep asking these silly questions, because I'm confused.
I think the idea that if it's not open space and it's not counted towards lot coverage, it's green, is not true. where we end up with gravel spaces, still built spaces that aren't necessarily. That's why there's building that margin in for those things. So it's setting aside what is an open space versus gravel or patio or somebody's deck under 30 inches or something like that.
Well, I guess the question is then who's to say what, I mean, that goes back to the question of open space. And then if that is open space and someone goes and puts, you know, is the open space dedicated, have an easement on it, preserved on the plat? Can someone go and put a deck in there? I mean, this is all really needs some, I guess, clear understanding. I'm still advocating we just eliminate the open space requirement if we have a total lot coverage for the development. I don't know how we're going to enforce it. I mean, what's the difference between gravel and green? And who's going to be the police on the fact that it's gravel or green?
Does pervious or impervious play a factor at all in regards to the implications on stormwater with the type of development on site? Is that outside of this discussion?
I think it would be complementary. I mean, how you satisfy your stormwater requirements will be based on impervious or pervious. But also it could be, you know, it could be totally moot. I mean, you could tank it. You could build underneath. But that it all depends. That's pretty, I would keep stormwater out of it just try to down some zoning restrictions.
But hadn't we talked last time or one time previously about essentially changing the permitted area of driveway depending on what type of material it was? So is that part of this conversation?
Yeah, Dustin, can you go back and pull that diagram in the center of page 9? That might be useful for us to have a discussion about this.
Yeah, I'm going to it.
Yeah, so from an open space perspective, if we intend to have it, the question is how are we going to enforce it and preserve it? So I guess the question for everyone, I mean, does everybody think we should have it in addition to a lot coverage standard?
Well, I guess I would separate that question out again and say that because we're looking at a new type of a new product here, essentially a new housing product, should we be separating out housing from parking and driveway? And I would argue we should. Because I think this is a case, you know, I know I flew swag the last couple meetings, but if our goal is to get more housing, you know, within the reach of more Hood River residents, and we know that the cost of parking is going to raise the price of that, I really think we need to visit this whole idea. I really think it's a social justice issue. I mean, we're saying that housing and parking are all falling into the same number. And then to say that each of these requires a space, I think is a problematic place to be. it falls on, we're saying, oh yeah, lot coverage includes housing and parking. It's like, but then why are we saying each of these has to have a parking place when we don't even know that the market is demanding that and our goal is to build housing? That's the space issue I'm struggling with.
Agree.
So, I mean, it seems like the parking is just totally separate discussion or not.
Well, when I asked it, when we talked about lot coverage and we said, well, lot coverage is housing and parking and driveway, that's why I guess I don't think it is separate. It's all kind of part of the, all this adds up to 100% at some point, right? So. if we break
well,
it out.
I think
out,
for me, the lock coverage has to do with, I think somebody had said it earlier, right, which is just how much physical building is on the site. And so for me, if the unit, and I'm going to include the parking and the driveways, but I mean, for me, it all counts towards just how much isn't going to be left over as green space and grass and trees and things like that. So the neighborhood is going to change pretty dramatically if we get rid of the open space requirement. So from my perspective, I think we should continue to have a open, or I'll call it a lot coverage requirement, right? Which is, you know, what's built environment versus natural environment, more natural environment. And I think
well,
if
I would
we
also.
End, yep.
Oh, you can finish. Go ahead. Sorry.
Or, I think I was there actually.
Oh no. Okay. I would endorse the open space requirement as well, because it also specifies or can specify the minimum dimensions. So it's not just lot coverage, but it's also taking that chunk out of the site that doesn't get developed. So you don't have, you know, the massing doesn't take up the whole buildable footprint of the lot, but you end up having I know in City of Portland, some of their stuff, the minimum open spaces has to be like 20 by 20 or 200 square feet, and it has a minimum dimension of 8 feet. You know, so you do end up, it prevents you from taking that full buildable envelope and provides that more space and, you know, what you were getting at right there, Mark.
Yeah.
And the question about the stormwater earlier, I mean, I think some of those standards are also meant to address, you know, tie in with, you know, trying not to create completely impervious area. But as Dustin said, there are alternate methods for dealing with stormwater.
Dustin, could you share your screen and put up the diagram, page 9 again? I'm trying to understand, you know, if we're going to put an open space requirement on these developments, tell me where that would be. And I know you had your cursor and you highlighted some of it, but then how do we preserve it? And I guess, are we saying that if we have open space and we're intending to preserve it, and it has to be minimum, it has to be of specific sizes, then there has to be an easement on it. There's got to be, you know, some CC&R covenant to protect it. Or how is the guy over here, you know, lot number one, not just going to stick his vegetable garden there, or his garden shed, or any number of things?
I think that's where the CC&R shows up. And it's also just like not unlike a single family home, you permit it, or a duplex, what stops someone from paving over their front yard? The question's not different. The idea that this is built in common area and built in to within the code, a CC&R requirement for common space. I mean, it's right in the applicability. The intent is to kind of establish, not only for us, but also between neighbors, the expectation.
So if you look at the diagram on the left, and I'll ask this for maybe the folks who are advocating that we have open space, where is it? I don't see open space. I don't see a 30% open space requirement being appropriate in this type of housing product. I mean, is it the driveway?
Well, I think it's everything but the driveway in the house. I mean, I think the question here
right.
is in,
how useful is that? I mean, what's
and these,
back
well,
to, back
but they're also diagrams, and we don't necessarily want everything to look exactly like that plan. I think the approach is to make, you can have an open space requirement. It doesn't necessarily, I don't know, Dustin, if like per unit is correct or per development or based on lots. But I think you need to allow the flexibility for the developers to decide whether it's common or whether it's divided. So I don't know how you would draft it, but is there a way to have an open space requirement, make it flexible so the developers have the control, whether it's owned by one person or four people, but that there is a certain percentage of the lot that remains in open space.
So yeah. That's where the 30% shows up. 30%. Whether you're, the other part was on a unit by unit, that becomes scalable. So the difference of whether you have a 3-unit or a 30-unit, or not 30, but 12 at the most, it should be included. The idea of whether it's scripted in a common space or just available at large to let the developer do as they see fit, I think that's where it's something. And it's not only for the users on site and the people, it's also, remember, this is the idea of some level of compatibility. If you have a 5-foot yard requirement and your neighbor moves in,
exactly,
you with nothing and can pave from side to side, that's the, again, the idea of promoting some level of compatibility with the what we have now. Your lots now, anywhere between 40% and 65% is the built. So if we're allowing an increased density, you know, there is some measure in kind of make sure that it's not just built with density, an added density, and not commensurate open space.
I guess I'm just particular. I just
and that the open space isn't just a band around the property line.
Well, I mean, so I guess the Dustin's comments. It seems like the lot coverage accomplishes everything that you just talked about, and in these diagrams, all I see is a band of around the properties. I don't see any, like what Erica is talking about or Amy's talking about, of like, hey, you know, we're going to have our whole get together and have a soccer tournament.
Yeah. That's where this diagram is just used for access questions. Not so much of an open space requirement. That's why I have the prototypes that break down the amount of built area, the amount of access or dedicated to shared, and then what's left over. I mean, that's really, this diagram is just used for access purposes, not really for an intelligent conversation on open space. That's where.
Well, and didn't this discussion begin with is 30%? Where did that number come from? And is that the right number?
Yeah, PUD, and it fits within all the prototypes. So that number is a PUD number. So that does have some aspect within our current code, and all the prototypes created, none of them broke that.
But to be clear about a PUD though, since I live in one, the 30% open space is on top of the open space per lot. So if you have, like in my neighborhood, 10 lots, there is a coverage criteria that we have for how much house you can put on your lot. If you have a 10,000 square foot lot, I think it's, I forget what the number is, 20%, 30% or something. So there's green space around the houses. And then in addition to the green spaces around the houses on your own personal lot, there's open space in the neighborhood. Am I right with that?
We don't always have an individual lot coverage on it. You may by way of circumstance.
We do, but yeah.
By way of CC&R in private.
Yeah. But I'm thinking of Dana Lane and Katie's Lane and all these others, right? So there's going to be some green space around the houses. And then in addition, there's 30% that the neighborhood has to carve out. They don't count the green space around the houses. And anyway, I think we're getting off tangent, but my point would just be is compatibility wise, 30% is pretty tight. I think in most PUDs, there's going to be a lot more than 30% open space.
Because it's actually a separate track or specifically identified versus
right.
Part of a person's property.
Right. They don't count the open space. They don't already include the person's backyard. Outside of that, like if we looked at this diagram here on the screen, we would see these four units with front yards or backyards or whatever it might be. But then in addition to all of that, there would be a 30% open space added on.
So I'm going to say it again and see if I can get anyone to advocate or agree. I feel like we should get rid of the open space requirement and rely upon a lot coverage requirement, because I don't see the difference. And if we're trying to, you know, simplify, streamline, eliminate, I don't see the benefit of sticking it in there. If we put a 60% lot coverage requirement and we say that, you know, basically buildable area, parking area, pervious and impervious, whatever surfaces are included, I don't see any reason why we would have an open space requirement. Because 40% of it we know is not going to be hardscape or built.
Dustin, do you want to take a look at how we might write that?
I would be clarify what counts and what doesn't. To the contrary, it could just make an open space requirement and leap and omit the lot coverage requirement.
Right.
It seems like we should do one or the other to me. That's what I'm trying to advocate for.
So here's a unit by unit, this much open space per unit or this much per development site, and don't try to complement it with something else. Just that's it. One or the other, or this is what you can build. That's it.
The challenge is if we do, I'm comfortable with lot coverage because we know then that, you know, someone isn't going to basically pave over the entire thing or concrete the whole place, right? Because they can't do that. And I'm thinking of an example where we've got, let's say we've got two duplexes on the site, two stacked units or something like that. I don't know which particular example, but it seems like the lot coverage is going to dictate unit size, driveway, hard surface area, all that stuff.
Can someone do math? I'd be curious what percentage of the lot is outside of the, or within the setbacks on a, you know, 7,000 square foot lot.
Sorry, on a 7,000 square foot, what percentage is inside the setbacks?
Yes.
So
is that 10%? Is that 25%?
10%. The rear yard is 10%. The front yard is approximately 7% because the driveway goes through it. And each of the rear yards, 6 feet by 80, 480, you end up with about 25% in the setback, roughly.
Okay. So if we're going to a 60% lot coverage, that means there's still 15% that has to come out of that setback kind of envelope or within.
In addition,
right.
So you might
in addition to the setback.
Yeah. Yep.
Driveways, I think, are permitted in setbacks, just to add that additional comment.
Yeah, that was the comment, Dustin, you made earlier about not allowing anything in the setback. But I know, like, even just the first example in the sets, the plans, it shows a driveway in the setback.
That's listed in permitted obstruction.
Okay.
In the front yard setback, up to 10 feet wide. So it's not a 30-foot wide driveway is permitted. There's a limited amount of real estate, and that's explicit. It's explicit in the code.
Okay. Except when I looked at it, it was kind of a straight line where you drove down the driveway and then you ended up in your parking space at the end. So then does that mean you're allowed to park in the setback?
No. Setbacks are not allowed, or driveway.
So if you look at your first example, I'm trying to find which document it's in. The draft, it's the one with the Sarah.
Oh, I'm going to the duplex.
The first one, even the first and the second one, actually. Yeah, that one, right? So the theory is the third car goes straight back all the way to the end and is parked at the end of that long driveway. Anyway, small thing, but they would be parking in a setback.
Yeah, I think it's been changed and it would not be allowed. Just so we didn't end up with parking all up on the within the lot lines, adjacent to lot.
Yeah. Okay, shall we move on to the dwelling size topic? So, and maybe we can include dwelling size and height.
Purposes of item one, I think they have consensus that the environmentally restricted should be included in whatever open space.
Yep.
We're taking that out. Okay. I'll make that amendment.
And then I think the second topic on that was just, is there a way to have one or the other, but not both, lot coverage and open space?
I guess, I'd be looking for a consensus on that too. Regulate by coverage or regulate by open space, if that's the consensus of the group. Or if there's a one, not both. Because then I'll invest my time in describing what that is, what constitutes.
I'll state my position, which is anybody else to see if they agree or not. Mine is that we should rely upon lot coverage and setbacks for this development format. And I don't think we need an open space in addition to that.
Bill, I think I'm okay with that too. How about others?
I don't know. I feel like it's a riddle where I'm trying to find the trap that we haven't thought of yet. So from that standpoint, I sort of like the idea of protecting open space so we know it's protected. I'm still thinking of just different ways that lot coverage might be used or abused. So I sort of like the idea of saying 30% can't be paved over with anything. So I guess I'm in favor of the open space.
You're favoring the open space?
Yeah.
It might end up being the same thing, but yes.
Yeah, exactly. It might.
It sounds better to protect the open space than to try and figure out how to maximize lot coverage. I think that's right. Where I'm at as well. It feels better to protect the open space than to figure out ways to maximize lot coverage. But so if open space is an easier thing to wrap your head around, I would vote for that then.
Well, I feel like there's more work we can do with the buildable parts of it. We might want to parse that out some more. So that's my thing.
Okay, so
I agree. I would like there to be one standard, not two, and I would lean towards an open space requirement.
Okay, Erica and Amy? Amy?
Yes, I could go with open space requirement as long as it's percentage based, right? So the lot scales up. But
yeah.
It's not a, 200 square foot. Requirement.
Yeah, that sounds fair. Yep. Okay, I know it's getting late, but let's move on then to this topic around the size of the unit. And I think maybe we could combine the height and the size. The 600 square or 600 or 900 square foot footprints versus 1500 foot total volume versus just let the site coverage dictate. So what are people's thoughts around that? Dustin, you want to give us any parameters to think through this around that?
Yeah, just as clarification, I heard somebody mention a 900 square foot unit size restriction. It's just a 900 square foot footprint that it says on there. So it's the ceiling ends up being, again, back to this statement of 1,100 square feet attached, or excuse me, 1,100 square feet without a garage, attached 1,500 square feet. That ends up being just the hard ceiling on regardless of unit configurations. The 25 feet also becomes important for, and Bill kind of raised this, is when it came to a building code issue. When you end up with a third story a third story dwelling unit, we end up with a what's known as aerial apparatus driveway or aerial apparatus route, which requires the units to have that a 26 foot wide driveway access to them. That becomes extremely difficult and consuming of a lot. So on this, if we ended up having dwelling units getting back, if I have a third story dwelling unit at the rear of a lot, I end up with a 26 foot wide driveway requirement on site for it. That is very difficult for somebody to, well, it has a big impact on buildable area. So some of these, when they have access from the street and all curb cuts, you can get that from the street, but you can't get it in the rear of the units without this apparatus. So that was a pinch point when it came to fire and buildability. And part of the reason why the two-story becomes much more consistent with the end, with fire code and with access code. The other piece on this is, and I think this is the tension of, some of the goal is to have a more affordable unit. If we start getting into our, and I think Bill might have mentioned this too, is, if you start getting into the dwelling units of 1500 square feet plus, and they're $300 a square foot build price, you're ending up product that is getting to 450, to 600,000 range. Is that necessarily your target market audience that you're trying to work for? Or have we just sized our way out of the affordability standard? There's kind of a balancing act between that. And how do you build that in? The point is to have a more affordable, more diverse option that provides opportunity for people who aren't in the 600K market. So, the idea of scalability, density, and affordability all come to play here. So I guess that was my housing commentary and some of the tensions that are trying to be resolved in the code.
So if it was 28 feet, we would still maintain, we would still end up with three-story homes.
Using the current, that's, if you look
we
what
can do it.
8 feet gets you now, you end up, your townhome attached product ends up being three-story, garage.
Three-story, yeah.
And that's kind of the predictable outcome based on some experience. Just becomes a real challenge when it comes to fire access.
Okay, what do people think? Let's kick us off.
I don't care about height or the square footage size. I'm more interested in preserving views. And I wrestle with my friend's story from this past week of Bend, where I don't know if anybody's paying attention to what's happening there right now, but it's pretty insane. And I feel like we're the next stop on the train. There is a 10 unit, they're calling it a tiny home complex. Each unit is 900 square feet, two bedroom, two bath, 2,500 square foot lots each, if they were to be divided up. Highly efficient. They're being marketed as energy efficient. The first unit went on the market last week and sold for $100,000 over the asking price in cash. The second unit my friends got for the asking price is $740,000. And they're probably all going to sell for that much. So the fact, I think that 900 square foot, I don't think price per square foot is not going to matter anymore when you have the Bay Area all moving up here. So I really don't even understand how, how we can affect the affordability of these when somebody's willing to pay $850,000 cash for a 900 square foot house.
It's a supply and demand issue. If the supply was unlimited, they would not be paying that.
Right.
Well, and the situation is totally different than it was a year ago.
Yes.
I mean, and Megan makes a great point, because regardless of square footage, the bar, the threshold, the bottom level cost is already going to be so high. It goes back to the land cost.
Yeah, an R2 lot, a 50 by 100 lot in the Heights on 4th Street is currently pending for $325,000. I mean, it's just, that's the reality that we're in. The subdivision, affordable subdivision lots behind Rose Hours in Mountain Vistas are selling for $250,000 to $300,000 for a subdivision lot. So the way that we have to overcome this is we have to put more dwelling units on each piece of land. That's the only possible way we're going to resolve this issue. So I go back to making small houses. I mean, if you say, you know, on your 5,000 square foot lot, you can stick two cottages, the math will never work. We need to be putting four cottages on a 5,000 square foot lot, in my opinion. And we haven't got to that part of the code yet, but that three is not enough. Like, I would love to see that project that Joel did, which was a stacked duplex on a 2,500 square foot lot. I'd love to see us permit something like that. I'd love to see someone put two of those on a 5,000 square foot lot. So that, I'm just broken from an economic perspective right now.
I think what you're looking at, though, is, you know, in the R1, 100% density bonus already. I mean, you're doubling the density. In R2, it's a minimum of 50% density bonus right now. How do you keep within the idea of scalable and achieve?
How's it a 50% density bonus?
You allow two, and you, two to three is 50%.
Could we go to the table again so I understand? Because I still was not there in what I was reading. 3,000 square foot, two. So you get three. I mean, R3, that seems certainly a place where that number should be something different. I mean, we should have four units on a 5,000 square foot lot. If we're in table page 6.
The other consideration would be corner lots. If corner lots can have some special treatment in regards to fire truck access, and maybe they could be allowed to be have that third story living space. Just in how we can squeeze out the most units.
Yeah, I think in a lot of areas, especially Portland, they do give deference to corner lots. Part of it is you don't have to use the front yard for access. You know, we would mandate a side access so that the driveway and all the parking automatically goes to the rear. And then that's where I've seen other places of mandatory duplex or mandatory allowance for duplex or greater density at the corner, to where you're not between two neighboring dwellings. You have a street frontage.
Okay, should we keep going? Thanks, Bill. Any other thoughts on the density, size issue, height issue?
Yeah, I don't know what to say about density. I feel this economic question is sort of bigger than I'm going to pretend to be, you know, knowledgeable enough about to make a decision on. I like the idea we talked about earlier about getting the builders involved, and I don't feel comfortable sort of weighing in on this. Yeah, we need more smaller and less expensive things. It's how do we get
there? I mean, that's kind of what I was thinking as we talked about, or as Megan was talking about Bend, is like, it's almost like I forget the name of the units across the river in White Salmon, right? But, you know, sometimes there's a premium actually for these smaller units. There's less of a house to maintain, especially if you're coming up from the Bay Area and you want to use this as your vacation home. I mean, there's a smaller house to maintain. There's a smaller yard. There might be, you know, the ability to take it off the grid. I don't know. There's a few things which are sort of interesting about a smaller unit that I might pay a little bit more for than a monstrosity of a house, right? So it's an interesting dilemma. But I was, I was thinking to myself, you know, my wife, when she was a teacher, her first home was 850 square feet, three bedroom, tiny house. And that's what she could afford. And I'm thinking about the work that my kids does. And that's really, you know, suiting that need, and it's a smaller house. Now, yes, there's an economic problem with the cost of land, but once we get up into 1500 square feet, I mean, that's really the house that I live in, you know, it's sort of 1500 feet plus a garage. There's no way that's affordable. So, I mean, I like the idea of trying to figure out how we can build houses more like the 900,000 square feet type range to offer that out there to the community. I just, you know, we just have an economic problem with the cost of land on the West Coast. And I don't know that any of us can solve that problem.
I mean, the solution to the problem is we have to put more doors on there. From a developer perspective, if I can do four units at 800 square feet or two units at 2000 square feet, I mean, at some point the math breaks and you do the other one. You're gonna do the more units. And what I'm saying right now is the math is not breaking. It's not incentivizing people to do these things. We need more doors on these lots. R2, R3.
And not to go way, way down a rabbit hole, because I know it is getting late, but maybe for next time. My fear is, as we describe these, what I'm hearing is smaller, less expensive, lower maintenance. And I just feel like we're creating the perfect vacation home for more second homeowners. And is there any way, I don't know if it's legal, that we can write into this code some way so these stay homes for Hood River residents?
Well, that's where I exactly was going, Tina, was like, I don't understand why we haven't entertained an inclusionary zoning policy for these cottage clusters. Let the developers build 8 luxury $750,000 homes, as long as 2 of them are under $350,000.
But that still doesn't solve the problem of them going to residence versus crash pads.
Well, the two under 350, you have to, I don't know how exactly they do with inclusionary zoning, but you have to prove that you make less than a certain amount a year and you live.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't understand how we're not, like, we're going to do all this work with this and not get what Tina's talking about, unless there is an inclusionary zoning policy.
Yeah, there seems to be two sides to it, right? There's what we can do with the built environment side, and then there's the market. And if the city wants to help fix the market problems, then the city steps in. And I think even that was written, I think that was Thrive who made some comments around that in their memo. But I think, you know, from a quantity perspective, like Bill's saying, from a pure quantity and numbers of doors perspective, that's the lever we have in the Planning Commission.
Yeah. So is that a unit? So in this chart, this first chart, that's not really a sizing. Well, it can be a sizing issue, but the idea of one unit per 1500, that is where it goes up or down. 4 units per 5,000, that's one unit per 1250. You know, that's the density conversation that you're sort of having.
Yeah.
So, that's exactly it, Dustin. I mean, the other question I'm having is R1, We have some now. At some point, we're going to do our map changes that we've promised to do. And we are going to have a lot less of it, I think, when that happens. But we will still have some. Does that sound like everyone's understanding?
I expect the vast majority of your real estate out on the developable west side is R1.
That's what it is now.
Yeah, and until we go out and start doing sweeping zone changes, that remains R1 unless people want to change it.
Yeah. Did okay. I've been under the assumption that we were going to, at some point in the future, address the map changes that we had talked about as part of the West Side plan.
Well, this is working on what do the colors of the map mean?
Yeah, totally. Yep. I agree. Okay,
that's we're working on that part still.
Yep.
Okay. So I don't know if we're resolving anything here, Dustin, around this. I mean, I think what we're hearing is just the conflict between, if we can't get the numbers to work out, we're living in a fairyland. And is there a, should we use some of these test fits to try and see, you know, what would be an appropriate number, as Bill says, like, when does it start to pencil out? When does it flip over? And if there's any changes that would be required in this sheet.
Well, in the R2, R3, C1 camp, you know, those are all pretty static other than the units, you know, the ceiling on the units. Do you have consensus that you'd want to go to 1250? Is there four of you that would recommend that? I guess that's the magic number. I've heard from two.
For R3, are you saying specifically R2 and R3?
Well,
or just R3?
They're the same right now. I mean, so I guess you could adjust R3 to go to 1250, and that's versus R2. So is there an appetite for one or the other?
To clarify what you're saying, so one dwelling unit per 1,250 square feet?
Correct. And it's not necessarily one dwelling that is 1,250 square feet. That's the area of real estate necessary to achieve a dwelling
on the lot, and then it has to have setbacks or the open space or whatever we come up with.
Correct.
I mean, and that sounds fair for me. I'd like to see it in a diagram, but for an R3, 1250.
Yeah, I'm okay.
Sounds fair.
Yeah, I'm okay with that too, in R3, 1250.
I am too.
Is that four? Bill, are you going to be the fifth?
Yeah, I'm okay with that. I mean, I guess the point I would highlight for everyone is, like, would we want to see two units, or would you rather see three units on a lot that are, you know, we've got a maximum square footage here of, I think in the code said 1,100 square feet. You want to see three units at 1,100 square feet, or would you rather see four units at 600 square feet each? I mean, that's the discussion here. You know, 4 times 6 is 2,400 square feet of built area on a lot. 3,1100 is 3,300. We get another door, the unit's going to be more affordable because there's more of them on the lot and they're smaller. That's why I'm kind of advocating we look at this from a number of dwelling units perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah. The issue is you got to go up. I mean, if you look at some of the prototypes and test fits, you're going to have to go vertical to get those numbers. Mm-hmm. Just as a guide.
These are urban areas. These are areas on Cascade and Columbia and the Heights. And these are adjacent to our commercial zones. Yes. That's what we have to do. That's my opinion.
This R3, so is that you're saying R3 or R2?
Or get rid of the parking.
I mean, probably both.
Yeah.
I mean, getting rid of the parking doesn't get you any, doesn't get you more doors.
Gets right? you more buildable space though.
Yeah, but all you do is build bigger.
Yeah.
Don't get any more doors to get to the way you're going to get to any, the cost perspective is you have to have more doors on it, on that lot.
Right. We were saying you don't necessarily have to go up if I think her point is.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. So I would say certainly, I mean, it makes sense that there's a sliding scale and whatever that column is on the left or the second one, but I would advocate 1250 for R3, and I would see, you know, this goes back to, I'm just making these numbers up, but we really need some people to actually try and figure some of this stuff out and see what would be produced. I mean, I would say, do we want, and the question is, and then the issue is when we say 1250 for one of these, and someone comes back and shows us a picture of this is what I would do, at that point we can say, oh, okay, I like that, or that's appropriate here, that's not appropriate there. So it's hard for me to say whether I think it should be 1250 in R2 or not. I mean, I think so, but I don't know.
Okay, well, I got two or three in terms of size. What about overall size? Ceiling that's there now. I understand there's some graduated scaling that is interested, but beneath there, based on density, total ceiling right now.
Nobody else is going to go. I'll go. I mean, my worry, right, is that if we do this purely on a lot coverage perspective, setbacks perspective, and we don't, and then let's say we allow for three or four doors on the site, if we don't limit the square footage, again, this is maybe a test fit question, but go to a 3,000 or 5,000 square foot lot, 1,500 square feet or 1,250 a square foot, maximize it. I mean, I feel like we're going to be building a mansion, four mansions on a little site. So it would be interesting to take a look at some test fits, because it feels to me like if you go up, these could be really dense and way out of character with the neighborhoods that are there. If we allow it to become as big as possible, right? As opposed to saying, you know, once you get to four units, I mean, as Bill was saying, if you get to four units, then there's 600, 700, 900 square feet, right? I mean, that makes sense to me. But to say four units, but sky's the limit, it just feels like we won't have solved the problem, which is affordability.
Yeah.
I think that this is something that I was advocating for a while back, and we haven't talked about it lately, but I mean, Portland solves this, I think, via floor area ratio or something, right? They say, if you have one dwelling unit, you can build out this percent of the lot. If you have two dwelling units, you can do this. If you have three, you can do this. And I mean, I think to your point, Mark, that makes sense, because we want to drive people towards, instead of, you know, if every single additional unit they do is the same exact size as the next one, they're going to just build the maximum they can as big as they can, right? There's no incentive for them to make anything smaller. Whereas if we say the smaller they are, the more you can build, then right, we get more smaller. And this code doesn't do that. I mean, other than the other constraints like open space and parking and lot coverage and setbacks.
Right.
So I guess the short of it is I agree that having some size constraints on the dwelling units make sense. I don't know what, I feel like the 1100 number is possibly small. And I'm thinking if you have two 600 square foot footprints, plate sizes, and you stack them on top of each other and you're building a three bedroom house, it seems like maybe 1200 or something's a little bit more appropriate, but that's maybe a Mark or Erica question.
The Sarah team did say 1200 wouldn't break. So this is a model of two 1100s on a 7,000 square foot lot. This is going from what used to be an R1. They said a 1200 wouldn't break the model on this one. So just for 12, so there's a pro architect from Portland saying 1200 is not going to make or break this.
Only from a lot coverage perspective, though. Yeah. Dina, was that you?
I was just going to say 1,200 square feet just doesn't sound like a middle housing to me anymore. That just sounds like a single family home. I mean, I know we like things big in America, but, you know, 40 years ago, I mean, you look at the older neighborhoods. I mean, most homes were in that range, right? 1,200 to 1,800 square feet. And I think we've sort of gotten used to seeing these massive 4,000 square foot houses. So this suddenly sounds small, but that's not that small. So I would say 1200, that seems like the upper limit to me. Now, again, the economics of it is why I guess I'm keeping quiet. I feel like I'm just kind of making up numbers, but I don't want us to err on the side of allowing so big that we've shot ourselves in the foot and defeated the whole purpose of this.
Right. Seems like there should be some constraints, because if we built out town at this small size, there's, you know, people aren't going to spend that much for that much small square footage. Won't spend that much for that little.
So Dustin, we're currently capped at 1100 and then 1500 if there was a garage. Is that what the code says?
Correct. So that 1500 is what you would consider it, say 240 square feet for garage space. That's about 1260. So 1100 without garage, 1260 with, you know, considering a single family or a single car garage onto it.
Have we defined, do we have a definition for gross floor area?
I think didn't we?
Well, particular code set, I don't think.
Exterior walls, not including the porch or open areas. It's in the code set.
It's in this set, it's in this new code set or existing one?
No, put it in particular.
Okay. Is it under definitions?
I've been scrolling with sharing on, so I apologize for everyone who's trying to watch me pan through here.
Got it. I found it. So we should just say floor area. We don't need the word. We should use the defined term.
Oh, yeah. I think I should put gross floor area in the front as floor area meaning gross floor area, not net minus interior spaces.
Okay, Dustin, are we at a point where you've got feedback from today?
Yeah, I'm gonna make work on some scalable numbers as well as a common open space. And I think Greg Kraft stuck with us the whole time. So I'm gonna get his, you know, his volunteer work, because I think he got volunteered on this, and I'll probably touch base on some of those users as well.
Can we see if Greg has any comments? He's been sitting there silent for a long period of time.
I think he also got told to not say anything.
All right.
Just, I'm sorry, Mark, can I know everyone wants to go home, but just one more thing. before we go. ADUs somehow slid through here, and we talked about it, and I think we were kind of all over the map, but it got on here that they're not permitted, and I don't know why. I think if, you know, some of these configurations where there might be a garage or something that could have an ADU above it, I don't know why we're kicking that out. It doesn't make sense to me if our goal is to get more housing on these parcels.
I think it just came down to the idea that these are pretty small dwelling units. I mean, the ADUs are already 800 square feet. Just consider them a dwelling on this site. They're not really accessory. They're just another one.
But if one of these units is one of these larger units, couldn't they potentially parcel out part of their unit as an ADU?
Well, we allow two attached units. I mean, they can be attached, so it doesn't say they have to be attached in equal size. It just says this is your dwelling unit breakdown. So
someone could buy two of them.
What's that?
Sorry, I've got a lot of background noise. Never mind.
I think somebody could buy two of them.
Right. Yeah, I guess that's the point. I guess the ADU question is, is it really subordinate when it's the same size? But I think,
Dina, you were looking at the picture where, if I'm thinking of, you know, the 1,200 square foot unit, two of them with the garages in the back, why wouldn't we put ADUs above the garages in the back, right? So you'd have four units on the site.
Yeah, I guess I'm just trying to envision that there might be options where this could be a legitimate way to, for someone on their one unit to decide, you know, maybe down the road to say, oh, well, what about this room, you know, above the garage? Let's make it an ADU. And we're specifically putting in the code that they're not allowed. And I just don't know why.
Yeah, that was actually done in a little cottage cluster I lived in Madison, where it was two flats at the street front, and the garages for those units behind had two 400, 500 square foot ADU studios above them. And those actually sold first out of all of the cottages.
Yeah, or someone wanted to build later, right? They have a separate garage. Maybe they want to add to an apartment above the garage. I don't know. I guess I just don't see an advantage in expressly saying people can't do it when people might get creative and think of a cool way to do it. Just my two cents.
I guess it would need to be then articulated on how could you do it. Because essentially right now we have a lot coverage requirement as well as
an open space requirement
but also a standard in the rest of the code that we would need to either reconcile, saying, you know, notwithstanding the rest of the code you can do it here, how does it calculate in and what are the sidebars?
But I don't think, I mean, if you went up on a garage, I don't think it's going to affect any of the lot coverage or open space thing, right? It's really a height question and a massing on the site question more than it is a lot coverage question. So again, it's another door. It's another door on the site, which is good. But from a compatibility or massing point of view, it's yet another push to, you know, a real dense site.
Yeah.
But
yeah, well, we'll
have trees.
If you went up above, it's not really an issue, but if you had nothing and you went detached to ADU, now you do have a coverage issue.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think we would be. Yeah, sorry, Bill. Is it okay?
No, I mean, I'm torn on this one. It seems like I was advocating for doors, but it seems like we have the decision in my mind is we decide the density or intensity of use we want in each zone. And that's what we allow for. And ADUs are, I mean, I agree, an ADU probably is not much different than this particular thing. So it's a question of, in the R1 zone, if we have two front houses, do we want two ADUs? Then we just put four units on a 7,000 square foot lot in the R1 zone. Is that what we want? That's a more intense use. And that's the topic to talk about, I think. So I don't, does that make sense? I mean,
yeah.
I mean, in an R3 zone, I'm saying we should have four units on the lot, but you know, I guess the question is, do we think we should have that on in the R1 zone? And I had not pushed that far yet. But as soon as you say you can do that, you're going to get four units on an R1 zone.
Yeah, and maybe we should continue that discussion. I guess I don't know that I wanted that to just slide through without us talking through it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, before we wrap up, we have some meeting minutes to approve, draft minutes from January 4th.
Hey, Mark, before we get there, can we just talk about process for this? You know, make sure we're all synchronized, Dustin's synchronized. I mean, I still have a couple pages of notes, like what should I do with them? Dustin, do you want to have a proposal about next steps here? We got some feedback.
Well, we need to continue. You need to continue at a date certain because you open up the hearing. So that's important. If you have, I always take comments, so we don't have to wait for a hearing. And then I share them.
I'll just type them up and send them to you.
And then I could, what I'll do is at least a week in advance, the markups and changes will be to you. So I believe somebody could help me with calendar. February 2nd, Groundhog's Day. February 1st.
Every day is Groundhog's Day lately.
February 1st?
I was gonna say there's a certain irony to that, but I think February 1st would be your continuation and date.
Yeah.
At some point, we just got piles of comments from the public and a lot of written documents before the meeting, and I didn't get to read them all. Should we have an outline about maybe how we're going to march through the issues next time? Is that something that we could get organized? Chair or Dustin?
Yeah, I guess that would be, how do you want to handle public comment? They're in the record. I think everyone who submitted spoke except Greg, but I'll be talking with him ahead of time. I'm open to that. I'm open to suggestions. If you want to review them in context, I think some of them will be touched with some changes. So, and some clarifications. However, whatever the commission's wishes on that. And most of them came today. So, or I got one over the weekend, but some came pretty last minute. So
Do you feel, Dustin, do you feel like you could distill them, or do you want us to do that? Because I think it would be really useful to have, like, you know, in the next meeting, here are the 10 things we have to talk about in some organized manner.
Yeah, I don't know if they're going to be 10. I think they're thematically. I shrink.
So whatever the number is, I mean.
Yeah.
I think we're paralyzed without, I mean, we're paralyzed with this economic discussion, but I think if we can try and figure out from this test fit idea, what levers we have to pull. I guess I'm a bit concerned. The 1st of February is actually not that far away, 2 weeks from yesterday. So I don't know that we're going to have a lot of time for test fits in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah. I mean,
after 10 days.
It seems reasonable that maybe we could get to an organized code set with some our comments and the public comment, and then kind of give that code the blessing and then send people on the test fit.
Yeah. That makes more sense.
Yeah, and we are gonna have to go back and, you know, I think the right thing to do would would be to some extent send this on and have it see how it plays out in the real world. I think that, you know, we could get into economic paralysis, and we'll never know until it gets into the hood, you know, even in the best lab and best conditions, once it gets out there, is it going to generate what we want? So I think that's also an important learning, and be willing to circle back and evaluate it. So,
but what does that mean? Would we update the code? Because no one's going to follow this update unless it's code, right? So they're not going to take it. Oh,
yeah, right. No, there's there. No one can follow this unless it's code. I think that's regardless of their will. It's just not permitted. So, you know, that's part of it too, is, you know, not to just take the leap of faith, but if we don't do anything until we know
all. It doesn't happen. Yeah.
You're never going to know all the answers.
Well, it might be interesting to see if there's certain models in this set of models that we can pump out before the others, right? There might be an R2 one that is a good pilot. So I don't know if there's a phasing that we could do, but I'm really curious about the idea of the test fit.
Yeah. I will see if I can get architects to produce in a short order. Yeah, we'll see what their timing is on that. I don't do the test fits. I have pro team who's on schedule. So I'll work on that. We'll definitely see some code amendments based on what you guys submitted and refinements. We'll see if I can get to test fits in that time frame. We'll have some.
Okay. But for the 1st of February, then we will try and come up with a shortened list of topic areas to get some resolution on.
Page numbers and enumeration in the code set, please.
Okay.
Yeah, that's an easy thing to do in the time frame. Drawing's much harder. I think so if we have date, continuation date, that's good. And then we have I think you have minutes too before you.
Do we need to make a motion? I mean, are we in a hearing or is this a work session?
No, you opened up the hearing, so you would need an official motion to continue to date certain.
All right, I will entertain that motion. Who wants to make it?
I will make a motion that we continue the hearing on. Do we have a particular name for this, Dustin? On the middle housing code set?
Yeah, middle housing 2020-37.
Okay, I will make a motion that we continue 2020-37 until date certain, February 1st.
Monday, February 1st. Okay, do we have a second?
3 p.m.
Do we have a second?
Sure, I'll second.
I think that was Tina for a second. So we have a motion on the table for file number 2020-37, middle housing code update, continuance on February 1st. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, chair votes aye. Motion passes. Okay, now I will entertain a motion for the draft minutes from January 4th.
To approve the minutes from January 4th.
Okay, Amy has put the motion out. Anyone second?
I'll second.
Again. I'll second. This is Erica.
All right, sounds good.
It's Erica.
All right, so any further discussion? All right.
Nope.
How do you vote?
Aye.
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 Okay, chair votes aye. I don't think we need Megan at that point. I mean, Erica at that point. All right, motion passes. Thank you for that. Okay, Dustin, so we'll see you on the 1st and we'll work on a streamlined area topics to cover off.
Yeah, we'll have a modified code for you and we'll see how much we can get on the test fits and what we hear from our our folks on the in the development team, on the development side.
Okay. Thanks, everyone.
Thank y'all. Thanks for sticking.
All right. Have a happy week.
Thanks, everybody.
Be safe. Bye.
Good night.